my heart. I love you too. She squeezed harder before letting go. Can I have Mr. Sprinkles back? Marge quit work on Monday. I know because I got a text from her saying, I've decided to retire. I went by her house after I dropped London off at school. Work could wait. I didn't care what she wanted. What I wanted was to see my sister. Liz answered the door, and I could tell she'd recently been crying, though only a trace of redness in her eyes remained. I found Marge propped on the couch with her legs tucked up, wrapped in a blanket. Pretty Woman was playing on the television. It brought back a flood of memories, and all at once I saw Marge as a teenager again. Back when she had an entire life in front of her. A life measured in decades, not months. Hey there, she said, hitting the pause button. What are you doing here? Shouldn't you be at work? I know the boss, I answered. He says it's okay if I'm a little late today. Smartass. I learned from the best. Marge made room and I plopped down on the couch next to her. Admit it, you got my text and you came over because you're jealous that I finally quit the rat race. She gave a defiant grin. I figured it was time to live a little. I struggled in vain for a snappy comeback, and in the silence Marge poked my ribs with her feet. Lighten up, she said. No doom and gloom allowed in this house. She peeked over her shoulder. Was Liz okay? She finally whispered. I guess so, I answered. We didn't really talk. You should, she said. She's actually a very nice person. Are you done? I asked with a half-hearted smile. How are you feeling anyway? A lot better than yesterday, she answered.
Which reminds me, can I take London roller skating this weekend?
You want to take London roller skating? My disbelief must have shown because Marge bristled.
Believe it or not, I refuse to let all of you keep me cooped up in the house, and I think London will enjoy it. I know I will.
Left unsaid was that it would likely be something that London would remember forever, since it would be her first time. When was the last time you even went roller skating?
What do you care? It's not like I've forgotten how to do it. If you recall, I used to be pretty good.
It's not that, I thought to myself. I'm wondering whether you'll have the strength. I looked away toward the screen, convinced that Marge was in denial. In the freeze-frame image on the television, Julia Roberts was in a bar, confronting her roommate about money. Though I hadn't seen the movie in years, I could still recall the film practically scene by scene. Okay, I said, but only if you hit play so we can watch the movie.
You want to waste your morning watching Pretty Woman, instead of earning money?
It's my life, I said.
Well, just don't make it a habit, okay?
You're welcome to come by after work, but not before. I'll probably start needing my beauty rest. Just hit the play button already. She lifted her eyebrows slightly and pointed the remote.
I just started it a few minutes ago.
I know.
We used to watch this together.
I know, I said again. Just like I also know you've always had a crush on Julia Roberts. She laughed as the movie started up again. And for the next couple of hours, my sister and I watched the movie, calling out lines and sharing a running commentary, just like when we were kids. After the movie, Marge went to the bedroom to take a nap, while Liz and I drank coffee in the kitchen.
I don't know what I'm going to do, Liz admitted, with the expression of someone overtaken by events she can hardly comprehend. In Costa Rica, she seemed fine. She barely coughed, and it was hard for me to keep up with her. I don't understand how she could seem so healthy a month ago, and now...
She shook her head in bewilderment.
I don't know what I'm supposed to do. I canceled my appointments today and tomorrow, but Marge basically forbade me from taking a leave of absence. She wants me to continue working at least a few days a week, insisting that your mom can fill in as needed, that we should work out a schedule or whatever.
When she raised her eyes, they were full of pain.
It's like she doesn't want me around.
It's not that, I said, covering her hand with my own.
She loves you, you know that.
Then why is she essentially telling me to stay away? Why can't she understand that I just want to be with her as much as possible, for as long as possible?
She squeezed my hand in return as she stared out the window, unseeing.
She still wants to go to New York next week, she finally added.
You're not seriously thinking of going, are you? Roller skating was one thing, but a sightseeing trip to one of the busiest cities in the world?
I don't know what to do. She asked the doctor about it last night, and he said that if she was feeling up to it, there was no reason for her not to go since it's between chemo sessions. But how can I go and not think to myself, this will be the last time Marge sees this?
Or this will be Marge's only chance to do that.
She was looking to me for an answer, but I knew there wasn't anything I could say. Most of her questions, after all, were the same as my own, and I had no answers either. On Tuesday morning, the first day of December, I got a text from Marge asking London and me to dinner that night. It was a subtle way of telling me not to swing by the house before that. The thought depressed me, and after dropping London off at school, I arranged to meet Emily for coffee. In jeans and a thick turtleneck sweater, she looked as fresh-faced and youthful as a college student.
"You look tired," she observed. "Are you holding up okay?"
"I'm surviving," I answered, pushing a weary hand through my hair. "I'm sorry for not calling the last couple of days." She raised her hands immediately.
"Don't be. I can't imagine what you're going through. I've been worried about you."
For whatever reason, her words were a comfort.
"Thanks, Em," I said. "That means a lot to me." "Do you want to tell me what's going on?" she said, touching my arm.
For the next hour, I rambled on, my cup of coffee gradually cooling to room temperature. Listening to myself, I realized that since Emily had come back into my life, I'd been careening from one emotional catastrophe to the next. Even as she held me later, I found myself marveling that she was still willing to put up with me. For dinner that night, Liz went out of her way to cook something she knew London would enjoy. Shake-and-bake chicken, seasoned potatoes, and a fruit salad. My mom was just leaving as we arrived, and I walked her out to her car. Before she got in, she paused.
"Marge is refusing to let me give up any of my clubs," my mom said. "In fact, she insisted that I stick to the very same schedule, but Russ..."
She frowned in concern.
"She doesn't know how bad it's going to get. She's going to need help. It's like she's in denial."
I nodded, signaling that I'd been thinking the same thing.
"Do you know what she said to me just now? She wants Dad to come by to fix a few of the railings on the porch because they've got some dry rot. And some of the windows are sticking. And there's a leaking sink in the bathroom. She was so insistent about getting these things fixed, as if that even matters right now."
She gave me a baffled look.
"Why would she be making such a fuss about a few porch railings or the windows?"
Though I didn't respond, it finally dawned on me what Marge was doing. I suddenly knew why she wanted me to only come by in the evenings, why she was having Liz and my mom split time with her. I knew why she wanted my dad to come over and make repairs on the house and why she was insisting on taking London roller skating. Marge, more than anyone, knew that each of us not only wanted private time with her, but were going to need it before the end. With the side effects of the initial chemotherapy treatment diminishing over the course of the week, Marge grew steadily stronger, and all of us wanted to believe her treatment was working because we so desperately craved even a few more months with her. I know now that only Marge understood on some intuitive level what was really going on inside her body. She bowed to treatment in the first place, simply because it was what all of us wanted her to do. In hindsight, I realized that she understood, even as she'd said yes, that it wouldn't slow the progress of the disease at all. To this day, I still wonder how she knew. Liz and my mom organized a schedule such that one of them would always be at the house during the day, once Marge and Liz returned from New York. The Friday following my dinner at Marge's, my dad took a morning off work and showed up at Marge's with his tool chest and a pile of pre-cut railings in his trunk. He began the slow process of repair and took a break at lunch. Marge and my dad had sandwiches and sweet tea on the back porch, admiring my dad's handiwork to that point and discussing the Braves' prospects for the following year's season. On Saturday, Marge arrived at my house after art class, the very same art class where, unbeknownst to my sister, London had fashioned her Christmas gift, to take London roller skating. Liz and I tagged along with them, watching from the gallery as Marge helped London inch around the rink. London, like most kids, kept trying to walk in the skates rather than glide, and it took a good half an hour before London began to master the motion. Had it not been for Marge holding both of London's hands, Marge was skating backward. My little girl would have wiped out at least 20 times. However, by the end of the session, they were able to skate side by side, albeit slowly, and London was visibly proud as she finally untied the laces with Liz's help and turned in her skates. I took a seat next to Marge while she bent over and removed her own skates. "Your arms and back are going to be sore tomorrow," I predicted.
To my eyes, she looked tired, but I couldn't tell whether it was because she was sick or because catching London over and over before she fell was understandably exhausting.
"I'll be fine," she said. "London's not very heavy, but she is a chatty little thing. She talked and talked the whole time. She even grilled me on what my favorite color of fish was. I had no idea what to tell her."
I smiled. "New York will probably seem restful by comparison. You're leaving tomorrow?"
"Yeah, I can't wait," she said, perking up. "I've told Liz that our first stop is the Rockefeller Center Christmas tree. I want to get in the spirit of the holidays."
"Text me some pictures," I said.
"I will," she promised. "By the way, I know what I want for Christmas," she said pointedly. "From you."
"Do tell."
"I'll tell you when I get back, but here's a little hint. I want to go somewhere with you."
"Like a trip, you mean?"
"No," she said, "not a trip."
"Then where?"
"If I told you, you wouldn't be surprised."
"If you don't tell me, then how can I do it?"
"How about you let me figure that part out, okay?"
With her skates off and her shoes back on, I saw her cast a last wistful look toward the rink. It was getting crowded now, filling with children, groups of raucous teenagers, and a few nostalgic adults. By Marge's expression, I knew she was thinking to herself that she was never going to have the chance to skate again. Today, I realized, hadn't simply been about teaching London to roller skate, or making a memory that London might hold on to forever. Marge had begun the process of saying goodbye to the things she loved, too. Marge and Liz were gone for 6 days. While they were away, I worked long hours, wanting to get as much done on the new ad campaigns as possible, but mostly trying to keep myself from dwelling on my sister. As promised, she'd texted me photos of the Rockefeller Christmas tree, one of her and Liz together, and another shot of her by herself. I had the pictures photoshopped, printed, and then framed, with the intention of giving one set to Marge and Liz as a Christmas gift, and keeping another set for myself. Meanwhile, I was contacted by 2 more law firms, including a small firm in Atlanta that had stumbled across my recent work on YouTube. As I started to put together the requisite presentations, I found myself reviewing the past 6 months. When I'd started my agency, it seemed as though all my worries were business or money related, and at the time, I found the stress overwhelming. Things I'd thought couldn't get much worse, yet I could distinctly remember Marge reassuring me that everything would turn out fine in the end. She was right, of course. On the other hand, she couldn't have been more wrong. The holidays continued to approach.
"What are your plans for Christmas, with London?" Marge asked me.
It was Sunday afternoon and she'd just woken from a nap, but still looked tired. We were on her couch, where she'd wrapped herself in a blanket, even though the house felt warm to me. She and Liz had returned from New York the day before, and I wanted to see her before London returned from Atlanta.
"Have you and Vivian discussed that yet? Christmas is only 2 weeks away, you know."
As I stared at my sister, it seemed to me that she'd lost even more weight since I'd seen her at the skating rink. Her eyes had a sunken look about them, and her voice sounded slightly higher and thinner somehow. "Not yet," I said. "But again, it's falling on one of her weekends."
"Russ, I know I've said it before, but it's not fair for you not to have any holidays with London."
No, it wasn't. But there wasn't much I could do about it, so I attempted to change the subject. "How was New York?"
"It was amazing,"
Marge sighed. "But the crowds, wow. There were lines down the block just to get into some of the stores. The shows were fantastic, and we had some truly unforgettable meals." She mentioned some of the musicals they'd seen and restaurants where they'd eaten. "It was worth it then?"
"For sure," she said. "I had the hotel arrange a couple of romantic evenings while we were there, too. Champagne, chocolate-covered strawberries, rose petals trailing to the bed. I'd also brought along some new lingerie to show off my newly svelte figure."
She waggled her eyebrows. "I think I blew Liz's socks off."
"Why didn't you want her wearing socks?"
"Really? That's your thought process?" "When my sister starts talking about her love life, I choose to retreat into naivete," I explained. "It's not like I share details about my love life."
"You don't have a love life with Emily yet, and if you ask me, it's about time you did something about that."
"We're in a good place right now," I insisted. "We talk every night on the phone, see each other for coffee, and we went out on Friday night."
"What did you do?"
"Dinner. And karaoke."
"You did karaoke?"
That caught Marge by surprise. She did. Then again, it was her idea. She's pretty good, too. Marge smiled as she burrowed deeper into the couch. That sounds like fun, she said. Not really sexy or romantic, but fun. Any bites on your house yet? There have been a few nibbles here and there, but nothing official yet. My realtor says that December is always slow. She wants to do an open house in January. Let me know when. Liz and I will come by as ringers and talk up the place in front of potential buyers. You have better things to do than go to an open house. Probably, she conceded. Then again, you always seem to end up needing my help in one way or another. I've had to take care of you my whole life. She glanced in the direction of the kitchen where Liz was preparing lunch. I'm supposed to have more chemo this week. Next Friday, I think. I'm not looking forward to that at all. She sighed, a flicker of apprehension crossing her face. She turned to me. With that in mind, we should probably do our thing on Thursday. What thing? Our trip, remember? She said. My Christmas present? You do realize that I still have no idea what you're talking about. That's okay. I'll pick you up at 7. Liz can get London ready for bed if that's all right with you. Of course, I said. She stifled a yawn, and I knew it was time for me to go. I guess I should take off. I've got a ton of work I want to get done before London gets home. Okay, she said. I'm looking forward to Thursday night. Make sure you dress warmly. I will, I promised. I rose from the couch, hesitated, then leaned back over to kiss my sister on the cheek. Her eyes were closed. See you later. She nodded without answering, and by the sound of her breathing, I knew she had fallen asleep again, even before I'd reached the front door. Vivian delivered London around 7 p.m. that evening. While the limousine idled out front and London was in the bath, we spoke briefly in the kitchen.
About Christmas, she said, cutting to the chase. I think it would be best if we spend it here. For London, I mean. It'll be her last Christmas in this house. I can just stay in the guest room if that's all right with you.
She reached for her purse and pulled out a slip of paper.
I've already bought some things, but it might be easier if you picked up some of this other stuff so I don't have to haul everything back here. I made a list. Just save the receipts and we can split it all up at the end.
Whatever's easiest, I agreed, thinking back to what Marge had said about the holidays, knowing she'd be pleased. I saw Marge today, I said, leaning against the counter.
How's she doing?
She's already beginning to sleep a lot. Vivian nodded, lowering her gaze.
It's just awful, she said. I know you think Marge and I didn't get along that well, but I always liked her. And I know she doesn't deserve this. I want you to know that. She's always been a great sister.
She still is, I said. But even as the words came out, I wondered how much longer I'd be able to say them. After school on Wednesday, Emily and I planned to take the kids out to a Christmas tree farm, where you could choose and have your own tree cut down. Much of the place was decorated like Santa's village, and kids could meet Santa before visiting his workshop, where hot chocolate and cookies were served. Even better, the farm would deliver and set up the tree in its stand, something I needed since I suspected that my Prius would otherwise be crushed beneath the weight of the tree. When I mentioned the plan to Marge, she insisted that she and Liz meet us there. It was 9 days until Christmas. In the gravel parking lot, Marge emerged from the car. When I hugged her, I could feel the sharp ridges of her rib cage, the cancer slowly eating away at her from within. She seemed to have more energy, however, than she had just after she returned from New York.
And this, I take it, is Bodie, Marge said, shaking his hand with touching formality. You're so tall for your age, she remarked, before proceeding to ask about his favorite activities and what he wanted for Christmas.
When the kids became visibly antsy, we let them run off toward the farm, where they were quickly lost between evergreen triangles. Emily and I trailed after them, strolling with Marge and Liz.
How is your holiday season shaping up, Em? Marge asked. Are you going anywhere?
No, she said. We'll just do the family thing like we usually do. See my sister and my parents. Ever since London learned to ride a bike, Bodie's been begging for one, so I guess I have to get him one, even if I'm not so confident about my ability to teach him to ride.
You'll help her out, won't you, Russ?
Marge said, elbowing me. I grimaced. Marge has always been good at volunteering me for things.
I seem to recall that, she laughed. Russ said you had a good time in New York?
The two of them fell behind a bit, engrossed in their conversation.
I looped my arm through Liz's and followed the path the kids had taken.
How's the schedule working out with Mom? I asked.
It's working, I guess. I cut back to 3 days a week at work, so your mom is going to come on the other 2 weekdays.
Marge seems to be doing well today.
She was a little fatigued this morning, but she perked up on the ride over. I think doing things like this makes her feel like there's nothing wrong with her, if only for a little while.
She was the same way when we were in New York. I'm glad she wanted to come. I just don't want her to get run down.
I've said the same thing to her, Liz said. And do you know what her response was?
I can't imagine.
She told me not to worry so much because she still has something important to do.
What does that mean?
Liz shook her head. Your guess is as good as mine.
As we stopped and waited for Emily and Marge to catch up, I pondered my sister's cryptic words. She had always been one for surprises, and I wondered what last mysteries she had up her sleeve. The next evening, Marge and Liz arrived at my house at 7 on the dot. As soon as Liz walked through the door, London took her hand and led her up to the bedroom to show her the aquarium. Marge was bundled in a scarf and hat despite the relatively mild temperatures. She also wore gloves and the oversized down jacket I'd brought to the hospital. It seemed impossible that less than 3 weeks had passed since she'd been rushed to the hospital.
Are you ready?
She said impatiently, clearly ready to leave. I grabbed my jacket and dug out a pair of gloves and a hat, even though I couldn't imagine needing them. Where are we going?
You'll see, she said. Come on before I chicken out.
I was still mystified, but as we began to turn down roads, I suddenly understood what she had in mind. You're not serious, I said as she pulled up to the gates and shut off the engine.
I am, she said firmly, and this is your Christmas gift to me.
Looking up, the water tower loomed. Impossibly, immeasurably tall. It's illegal to climb the water tower, I said.
It's always been illegal. That never stopped us before.
We were kids, I countered.
And now we're not, she said. You ready?
Get your hat and gloves. It'll probably be windy up top. Marge. She stared at me.
I can make the climb, she said in a voice that left no room for dissent. After another round of chemo, maybe I won't be able to, but right now, I still can, and I want you to come with me.
She didn't wait for me to answer. Getting out of the car, she strode toward the steel maintenance ladder, leaving me paralyzed with indecision. By the time I scrambled after her, she was already 6 feet in the air, which meant, of course, that I had no choice but to start climbing. If she got tired, if she became weak or dizzy, I had to be there to catch her. In the end, it was fear for her that spurred me to follow. Marge hadn't been lying. Though she had to take a break every 20 feet or so, she would inevitably start up again, moving relentlessly higher. Below me, I could see rooftops, and I caught the scent of chimney smoke. I was grateful for my gloves, as the metal rungs were cold enough to make my hands stiffen up. When we finally reached the top, Marge inched her way over to the spot where I'd found her on that terrible night back when she'd been in college. Just like then, she let her feet dangle over the narrow walkway, and I quickly moved to her side. I put my arm around her again in case she got dizzy. You must be feeling the cold, I said.
Speak for yourself, she retorted. I put on long johns before I came.
Fine, I said. Then slide your butt closer to me so I can get warm too. She did, and for a while we took in a bird's-eye view of the neighborhood. It was too cold for the nighttime sound of crickets or frogs. Instead, I caught the faintest murmuring of wind chimes and the sound of the breeze as it rustled the branches of trees. That and the sound of Marge wheezing, low and wet. I wondered how much pain she was in. The cancer, after all, always brings pain.
I remember when you found me up here, drunk as a skunk, she said. Well, not all of it. I actually don't remember much at all about that night, other than that moment when you suddenly appeared.
It was a rough night, I said.
I sometimes wonder what would have happened had you not shown up. I wonder if I really would have jumped, or maybe fallen. I was so heartbroken about Tracy at the time, but I look back now and can't help but think it was a good thing. Because in the end, I found Liz. And what Liz and I have is nothing like what I had with Tracy. Ever. She and I just work, you know?
Yeah, I know. You guys have something that everyone wants,
I'm worried about her, Marge admitted. She's so good at helping other people get through their problems, but I think she gives so much at work, she doesn't have much left for herself. And it scares me, because I want her to be okay. I want her to be happy.
She stared out into the distance, almost as if trying to see into the future.
I want her to one day find somebody new, somebody who loves her as much as I do, someone she can grow old with.
I swallowed, forcing the tightness from my throat. I know. When we were in New York, she swore she has no interest in ever finding someone else. And I actually got really mad at her. We had an argument, and afterward I felt so bad about it. We both did, but...
There's a lot going on, Marge, I said, my voice soft. She understands, and she'll be okay.
If Marge heard me, she gave no sign.
Do you know what else scares me?
What's that?
That she's going to lose contact with London. She loves that little girl so much. London is a big part of the reason we wanted to have kids of our own. And now?
Liz is always going to be part of the family, I cut in. I'll make sure that Liz plays a big part in London's life.
What if London moves to Atlanta?
Marge pressed. She'll still see Liz regularly, I assured her. But you're only going to have her on the occasional holiday and every other weekend, right? Maybe a couple of weeks in the summer? I hesitated. I honestly don't know what's going to happen with London, I said. Vivian had been more generous and less volatile since learning about Marge. But then she was the least predictable person I knew, and I was leery of making specific promises I couldn't keep. She turned toward me.
You have to fight for her, Marge urged. London should live with you.
Vivian won't let that happen, and I doubt that the courts will either.
Then you have to figure something out, because let me tell you something. Girls need their fathers. Look at me and Dad. He might not have been the most expressive guy in the world, but I always knew at some really deep level that he was there for me. And look at what he did for me when I came out. We stopped going to church, for God's sake. He chose me over God, over our community, over everyone. And if you're not around for London when she comes to her own crossroads in life, she's going to feel abandoned by you. You have to be there for her, every day, not just now and then.
She fell silent for a moment, as if winded by her efforts.
Anyway, she's used to you being the primary parent now, she added, and you're great at it.
I'm trying, Marge, I said. She grabbed my arm, her voice fierce.
You have to do more than that. You need to do whatever you can in order to remain in London's life. Not as a weekend or vacation dad, but as the parent who's always there to hold her when she cries, pick her up when she falls, help her with her homework, to support her when she can't see a way forward. She needs that from you.
I stared down at the empty streets below, washed by the halogen glow of streetlights. I know she does, I said quietly. I just hope I don't fail. On Sunday morning, the Christmas tree was delivered, and London and I spent the first part of the day decorating it, stringing lights among the branches and conferring over the placement of every single ornament. When I called Marge and Liz later that afternoon to see if they wanted to come by for some eggnog, Liz answered the phone and said they wouldn't be able to make it.
It's been a pretty bad day, Liz said.
Marge had undergone her second round of chemo on Friday, the day after the trip to the water tower, and I hadn't seen her since. According to Liz, the nausea and pain were worse than the first time, and Marge had barely been able to leave her bed. Is there anything I can do to help?
No, she answered. Your mom and dad have been here pretty much all day. They're still here.
She lowered her voice.
Your dad, I think it really kills him to see Marge like this. He keeps finding new things to repair. It's hard for your mom, too, of course, but she's been through it so many times that at least she knows what to expect. He's trying so hard to be strong for Marge, but it's destroying him inside. He just loves her so much, his girl. They both do.
I found myself thinking about what Marge had said that night on the water tower, about being the kind of dad who was there for everything, always. Even, it seems, at the end.
He's a great father, Liz, I said.
I hope I can be half the dad he is. On Monday, London's last day of school before winter break,
I finally got around to the Christmas list that Vivian had left me. Work had kept me busy most days, and in my binary focus on clients and Marge, Vivian's list had slipped off my radar. Luckily, Emily still had some last-minute shopping to do, so the two of us drove from store to store late that morning. With Christmas only 4 days away, I was worried that some items would be sold out, but I was able to find everything on Vivian's list. Halfway through our shopping, Emily and I took a break for lunch. There was a cafe at the mall, and though the food smelled good, I had little appetite. On the scale that morning, I saw that I'd begun to lose weight again. I wasn't alone. Liz was losing weight as well, and I noted that she sometimes looked disheveled, as if she no longer cared about her appearance. Her hair, often tied back in a careless ponytail, was losing its luster. My mom and dad, too, were suffering. My dad seemed to have acquired a defeated hunch in the past few weeks, and my mom's face was more deeply lined with worry with every passing day. But our suffering was nothing compared to Marge's. Walking was becoming painful for her, and often she struggled to stay awake for more than an hour. When I visited, I sometimes sat with Marge in her darkened bedroom, listening as she seemed to struggle to draw breath, even as she slept. Occasionally she whimpered in her sleep, and I wondered if she were dreaming. If only, I thought, she could dream the kind of dreams that would make her smile. Thoughts like these preoccupied me, even in Emily's company, no matter what the surroundings. When my lunch arrived, I stared at it blankly, picturing Marge's emaciated face. I took only a single bite before pushing the plate aside. If Marge couldn't eat, I guess there was a part of me that felt like I didn't deserve to, either.
"You need to come by the house," Marge said without preamble, right after I answered her call.
I just dropped Emily off a few minutes earlier.
"Why, are you okay?" "Do you really want me to answer that question?" she said, with a trace of her old sardonic humor. "But yes, I'm feeling better than I was, and I'd like you to come by. I have to pick up London from school in a little while, and drop off the gifts beforehand." "Swing by here on the way and leave the gifts with us," she said. "London won't find them that way."
When I reached her house a few minutes later, I started unloading the bags from the trunk. When I looked up, my mom appeared in the front doorway. Even with her help, it took two trips to unload everything. "I'm not sure where to put all this," I said, staring at the mountain of bags on the kitchen floor. Did London really need all this, I wondered.
"I'll put it all in one of the closets," my mom said. "Go on in, Marge is waiting for you."
I found Marge on the couch, wrapped in a blanket as usual, with the living room shades drawn. The lights from the Christmas tree cast a cheerful glow, but in the days since I'd seen her last, she seemed to have aged years. Her cheekbones stood out in sharp relief below the sunken pits of her eyes, and her arms looked ropey and flaccid. I tried to mask my dismay at her appearance as I took a seat beside her. "I heard it was a rough few days," I said, clearing my throat.
"I felt better, that's for sure. I'm on the mend now, but..."
She cracked a smile, a ghost of her irrepressible self.
"I'm glad you came by. I wanted to talk to you."
Getting the words out seemed to be an effort.
"Emily called a little while ago."
"Emily?"
"Yeah," she said. "You remember her, right? Gorgeous hair, has a 5-year-old son, the woman you love. Anyway, she called me because she's worried about you. She says you're not eating."
"She called you?" I said, feeling my irritation rise. Now Marge was going to worry about my health?
"I asked her to keep an eye on you and let me know how you're doing," Marge said in a bossy voice I remembered from childhood. "Which is why I then asked you to come over."
She scanned me with a critical eye.
"You better eat a decent dinner tonight, or I'm going to get seriously angry with you."
"When did you discuss keeping an eye on me with Emily?" I demanded.
"When we went to Santa's village for the trees."
"You have better things to worry about than me, Marge," I said, conscious of how sulky I sounded.
"That's where you're wrong," she said. "That's something that I won't let you take away from me."
Tuesday, December 22nd, was London's last day of school before the winter break, and that was when I planned to wrap all the gifts. Before I'd left her house the previous day, Marge asked if she could help with the wrapping, since the gifts were over there anyhow. When I arrived at the house with wrapping paper after dropping London off at school, my first thought was that Marge looked better than she had the day before.
Simultaneously, I hated that I had begun to make those kinds of evaluations every time I saw her, only to see my hopes elevated or dashed depending on how she seemed to be doing. Liz was home with her that day, and she exuded a forced good cheer as we brought the gifts to the kitchen and began to wrap. At Marge's request, she made us all cups of hot chocolate, thick and foamy, although I noticed that my sister drank little of hers. Marge wrapped a couple of the smaller gifts before settling back in her chair, leaving the rest to Liz and me. "I'm still not happy that you're calling Emily to check up on me," I groused. Despite her condition, Marge was clearly enjoying my discomfort, as evidenced by the gleam in her eye.
"That's why I didn't ask your permission. And if you're interested, we didn't just talk about that, by the way. We talked about a lot of things."
I wasn't sure I liked the sound of that. "What things?"
"That's between me and her," she said. "But for now, what I want to know is whether you ate last night. Full report, please."
"I made steaks for London and me," I sighed.
"And mashed potatoes."
"Good," she said with satisfaction.
"Now, have you spoken with Vivian about the plans for Christmas this year, other than that she'll be coming to Charlotte?"
The tradition in my family had been to gather at my parents' on Christmas Eve. My mom would make an elaborate dinner, and afterward we'd allow London to open gifts from the relatives while It's a Wonderful Life played on television. On Christmas morning at our house, Vivian and I would have London to ourselves. "We haven't gotten into the specifics yet," I said. "She doesn't come in until tomorrow. We'll figure it out then."
"You probably need to get her something," Marge pointed out. "For London's sake, so she can see her mom opening some gifts. It doesn't have to be anything big."
"You're right," I said. "I didn't think of that."
"What did you get Emily for Christmas?"
"Nothing yet," I admitted.
"Any thoughts yet? You're cutting it a little close."
"I don't know," I said, looking to Marge and Liz for inspiration. "A sweater, maybe? Or a nice jacket?"
"Those could be part of it, but she told me what she's getting you, so you'll have to do better than that."
"Like jewelry or something?"
"If you want. I'm sure she'd appreciate that, too. But I was thinking that you need to do something from the heart."
"Like what?"
"I think," she said, drawing the words out, "that you should write her a letter."
"What kind of letter?" Marge shrugged.
"You write for a living, Russ. Tell her how much she's meant to you these past months. How much you want her to remain in your life. Tell her," Marge said, lighting up, "that you want her to take a chance on you again."
I squirmed. "She already knows how I feel about her. I tell her that all the time."
"Write her a letter anyway," Marge urged. "Trust me, you'll be glad you did."
I did as Marge suggested. With London in tow, piano lessons weren't until the new year, I drove directly from school pickup to the mall, where I found some gifts for Vivian. Her favorite perfume, a scarf, a new novel by a writer she liked. I also picked out an embroidered silk jacket for Emily, one that I was sure would complement her rich coloring and slightly bohemian style, and a gold chain with an emerald pendant that would accent the color of her eyes. Later, after London had gone to sleep, I sat at the kitchen table and wrote Emily a letter. It took more than one draft to get it right. Despite the wordsmithing I did for my job, writing from the heart was entirely different, and I found it difficult to strike that delicate balance between raw emotion and maudlin sentimentality. In the end, I was happy with the letter, and grateful that Marge had made the suggestion. I sealed it in an envelope and was about to put the pad and pen back in the drawer when I suddenly realized that I wasn't yet done. Working until long past midnight, I wrote Marge a letter as well. Vivian got in a little past noon the following day, not long after I'd returned from dropping off the gifts at Emily's. With the tree already trimmed, London and I had spent the morning decorating the mantle and hanging the stockings. It was a little late in the season, but London didn't mind at all. She was proud to be old enough to help. I let Vivian visit with London for a while before signaling my desire to speak with her. Retreating to the kitchen while London watched TV in the living room, I asked her what she wanted to do for Christmas Eve. At my question, she stared at me as though it were obvious.
"Well, aren't we going to your parents' place like we always do?"
I know that it might feel a little strange considering what's going on, but it's Marge's last Christmas, and I want London to spend time with her and the family, like she always has.
That's why I came home in the first place.
Even though we weren't in love anymore, I thought to myself,
There were still moments when I was reminded of some of the reasons I'd married Vivian in the first place. Christmas Eve and Christmas Day unfolded much like they always had. The atmosphere was a bit stilted on Christmas Eve at first, for obvious reasons. Everyone was polite to each other, and there were kisses and hugs all around when Vivian, London, and I showed up at my parents'. But by the time I finished my first glass of wine, it was clear that everyone's sole aim that evening was to make the gathering enjoyable for London's sake. And Marge's. Vivian appreciated the gifts I'd gotten her. For me, she'd bought some running gear and a Fitbit. Marge and Liz oohed and aahed over the vase that London made for them, especially marveling at the colors of the fish that London had painted. Tears shone in their eyes when they opened the framed photos that had been taken in New York, and my sister took the envelope containing the letter I'd written with a tender smile. London received a bunch of Barbie stuff from pretty much everyone, and after the gifts were opened, we put on the movie It's a Wonderful Life while London played with her new toys. The only truly notable event of the evening took place after we'd finished opening the gifts. From the corners of my eyes, I watched as Marge and Vivian slipped from the living room, sequestering themselves in the den. The low hum of their voices was barely audible behind the partially closed door. It was odd to see the two of them speaking so intimately, let alone in private, but I knew exactly what was happening. Vivian, like all of us, had wanted the chance to say goodbye. On Christmas Day, once London had opened the rest of her gifts, I left the house so Vivian could have some time alone with London. To that point, we'd been together almost continuously during the previous 48 hours, and if I needed a break from her, I was certain that Vivian felt the same way. Cordiality, let alone forced gaiety, in the midst of a divorce and custody dispute, wasn't easy for anyone to maintain. I texted Emily, asking if I could drop by, and received a quick response, urging me to do so. She had a gift for me, she said, and she wanted me to see it. Even before I got out of the car, she was skipping off the porch toward me. Up close, she threw her arms around me, and we held each other in the pale sunlight of a cool December day. "Thank you for the letter," she whispered. "It was absolutely beautiful." I followed Emily inside, picking my way through a maelstrom of new toys and torn wrapping paper, at the center of which stood Bodhi's shiny new bicycle. She led the way toward the Christmas tree, and reaching behind it pulled out a flat, rectangular package. "I thought about giving this to you before Christmas, but with Vivian staying at the house, I thought it would be best to give it to you here." I tugged at the wrapping paper and it came off easily. As soon as I saw what Emily had done, all I could do was stare, the memory coming back to me in a rush. Overwhelmed, I couldn't speak.
"I had it framed, but you can change it to something else," Emily said in a shy voice. "I wasn't sure where you might want to hang it."
"This is incredible," I finally said, unable to tear my eyes from the image. Emily had painted the photo of London and me dancing outside the aquarium, but it seemed even more real, more alive than the photo somehow. It was by far the most meaningful gift I'd ever received, and I wrapped my arms around Emily, suddenly understanding why Marge had been so insistent that I write Emily a letter. She'd known that Emily was giving me a gift from the heart, and Marge wanted to make sure I matched it with one of my own. Once again, Marge had been looking out for me. The year rolled toward its inevitable conclusion. Vivian went back to Atlanta. I'd closed the office for the week and spent most of my time with London. I visited with Marge and Liz every day. Marge continued to rebound, rallying our hopes, and saw Emily three times, though twice in the company of the kids. The lone exception was New Year's Eve, when I took her out for a night of dinner and dancing. At the stroke of midnight, I almost kissed her. She almost kissed me too, and we both laughed about it. "Soon," I said.
"Yes, soon," she answered.
And yet, as romantic as that moment was, I felt reality beginning to take hold. In 2015, I thought I'd lost everything. In 2016, I suspected I'd lose even more. Chapter 25. For Auld Lang Syne. Marge's romantic plans for Liz in New York weren't without precedent. Around the 5-year mark of their relationship, Marge had surprised Liz with an elaborate scavenger hunt on Valentine's Day.
When Marge initially revealed her plans to me, I'll admit I was shocked because it seemed so unlike the sister I knew. After all, she was an accountant, and while generalizations might be unfair, she always struck me as more of a smart-alecky pragmatist than a mushy paramour. While Marge rarely showcased her romantic side, she could clearly hit it out of the ballpark when she chose to do so. Indeed, the scavenger hunt proved to be the work of a master planner. New York was child's play by comparison. The centerpiece of the Valentine's Day scavenger hunt, which involved locations all over Charlotte, was a series of 10 riddles. The riddles were set to verse and led to specific reveals. A sample.
Today, dear Liz, we'll have some fun. To remind you that you're my only one. So visit the spot where it's all about you. On early mornings and late at night, too. Then look to your left, my darling dear, and your very first clue will there appear.
Marge had taped the first clue, a small key, next to the bathroom mirror, which led Liz to a post office box that she had to open with the key. Inside the box was another riddle, and so it went. Some of the clues were tougher than others. One required Liz to finish a glass of champagne to find the next clue, which was glued to the bottom of the champagne flute. At the time, I was stunned by the breadth and inventiveness of Marge's scheme. Looking back, I'm no longer surprised by Marge's elaborate Valentine's Day plans or her meticulous footwork. I no longer think of it as out of character, because drawing up blueprints for other people's happiness was what she did best. My sister, the accountant, always had a plan, especially for those she loved. My memories of early 2016 are distilled into a series of vivid moments set against the muted backdrop of my day-by-day existence. The backdrop consisted of work, where I wrote, filmed, edited, and designed ad campaigns, London's care, before and after school, my daily run, and Emily, whose nightly phone conversations and occasional dates nourished and sustained me. Those routines made up the regular fabric of my days and also served as temporary distractions from the peaks and abysses that marked that period of my life. With the passage of time, I'm sure I've forgotten more than I remember. Some things I willed myself to forget. But other memories will remain with me forever. About a week into the new year, Marge went in for further tests. While I didn't accompany her to the hospital, my parents and I joined Liz and Marge when it came time to hear the results. We met the doctor in his office, across the street from the hospital. He faced us across a heavy wooden desk, a handful of family photos arranged next to a large stack of files. On the walls were shelves filled with books, and the usual assortment of framed diplomas, plaques, and citations. The only incongruous element was a large framed poster from the film Patch Adams. I only vaguely remember the film. It starred Robin Williams as a caring, kind, and funny doctor, and I found myself wondering if Dr. Patel aspired to be a doctor with similar attributes. Had there ever been anything humorous said in this room? Did any patients ever laugh when talking to their oncologist? Could any joke minimize the horror of what was happening? To us, Marge appeared to be improving slightly. She'd had more energy since the holidays, and her pain didn't seem quite as acute. Even her breathing seemed less labored. All of that should have pointed to good news. I could see the hopefulness in my parents' expressions. I noted the confident way Liz was holding Marge's hand. We'd shared our secret hopes amongst ourselves during the previous week, trying to draw strength from each other. Marge, however, didn't look hopeful. There was an air of resignation about her from the moment she took her seat, and I knew right then with certainty that Marge would be the only one who wouldn't shed a tear that afternoon. While the rest of us had remained stuck in various stages of grief, denial, anger, bargaining, depression, Marge alone had already moved on to acceptance. Marge knew, even before the doctor said a single word, that the cancer hadn't slowed its progression. In truth, she'd known all along that it had spread even farther.
"Please don't ask me how I'm doing," Marge said. "Mom and Dad just left, and Mom kept asking me that over and over. And Dad keeps asking what else needs to be fixed. I wanted to say me, but didn't think they could handle the joke."
We were sitting on Marge's sofa, as had become our custom, staring at the empty space where the Christmas tree had once stood. My dad had removed it a few days earlier, but the furniture hadn't been rearranged yet,
leaving a barren space in the corner of the room. "It's a hard day for them," I said. "They're doing their best."
"I know," Marge said. "And I love that Dad keeps coming around. We've talked more than we have in years, and not just about baseball."
She let out a breath before suddenly wincing. A wave of pain, somewhere, everywhere, made her entire body tighten before it finally passed.
"Can I get you something?" I asked, feeling more helpless than ever. "I just took a pill," she said. "I don't mind the painkillers, other than that they make me sleepy. They don't work as well as I want them to, of course. They blunt the pain a bit, but that's about it."
"Anyway," she looked toward the kitchen, where Liz was at the table, coloring with London. Lowering her voice, she said,
"I told Liz I'm not doing another round of chemo."
Her expression was grim, but resolute.
"She was pretty upset about it."
"She's just scared," I said. "But do you really think that's the right decision?"
"You heard the doctor," she countered. "It's not working. And on the downside, it makes me feel even worse. All I do is vomit and sleep, and my hair is starting to fall out. I'm losing whole days after the treatment, and I don't have that many days left."
"Don't say that," I pleaded.
"I'm sorry. I know you don't want to hear it. Nobody does."
Marge squeezed her eyes shut, wincing again at another wave of pain that, to me, took far too long to pass.
"I'm guessing London doesn't know I'm sick, am I right?"
I shook my head. "She doesn't even know that Vivian and I are getting divorced yet." Marge opened one eye to peer at me.
"It's probably time that you tell her, don't you think?"
I didn't answer, because I didn't even know where to start. There was too much to lay on a 6-year-old. Divorce and Marge dying and moving, maybe even as far away as Atlanta, leaving her father and her friends behind. I didn't want London to deal with any of it. I didn't even want to deal with it. As I felt the tears building behind my eyes, Marge reached over and placed her hand on mine.
"It's okay," she soothed.
"No, it's not okay. None of this is okay." I could hear my voice begin to crack. "What am I going to do about London? What am I going to do about you?" She squeezed my hand.
"I'll talk to London about me, okay? So don't worry about that. It's something I've been wanting to do. As for everything else, I've already told you what I think."
"What if I can't? What if I let you down?"
"You won't," she said. "You can't know that." "Yes, I can. I believe in you."
"Why?"
"Because," she said, "I know you better than anyone. Just like you know me."
The following Friday, in mid-January, Vivian flew into town to pick up London for the weekend. When I broached the idea that it was probably time to tell London about our impending divorce, she suggested that we do it when they got back. After all, she said, she didn't want to ruin London's weekend. The next morning, my realtor staged our first open house, and as promised, Marge and Liz were there, loudly talking up the house to each other in front of potential buyers. Afterward, my realtor called to tell me that she detected some genuine interest in the property from one couple in particular, who were relocating with their children from Louisville.
"By the way, your sister missed her calling as an actress," the realtor remarked.
On Sunday evening, shortly after their return from Atlanta, Vivian and I sat our daughter down at the kitchen table and gently broke the news. We kept the discussion at a level appropriate for a 6-year-old, emphasizing that both of us still loved her, and that we would always be her parents. We told her that she had nothing to do with the fact that we could no longer stay married. As she'd done the first time, Vivian led the discussion. Her demeanor was loving, and I felt that she struck the right tone, but London burst into tears nonetheless. Vivian held her and kissed her as she cried.
"I don't want you to get divorced," London pleaded. "I know it's hard, sweetheart, and we're so sorry. Why can't you just be happy with each other?"
London said, still sobbing. Her naive incomprehension triggered such a profound wave of guilt that I despised myself.
"Sometimes it just doesn't work," I tried to explain.
The words sounded meaningless, even to me.
"Is that why the house is for sale?"
"I'm afraid so, baby girl."
"Where am I going to live?"
At her question, my eyes flashed toward Vivian, silently warning her not to say Atlanta. Her expression was defiant, but she held her tongue. I put a hand on London's back. "We're still working on that. And I promise that no matter what happens, Your mom and I will both be around to take care of you.
Eventually, London calmed down, though she was clearly still confused and shaken. Vivian went upstairs with her and started getting her ready for bed. When she came back down, I intercepted her at the door. How is she? I asked.
She's upset, Vivian answered. But according to my counselor, that's normal. In the long run, she'll be fine as long as you don't make the divorce more acrimonious than it has to be. That's when kids suffer the most in these situations, and you don't want to do that to her.
I bit back a retort. I wasn't the one making this acrimonious after all, knowing it was pointless. Vivian gathered her things. The limo and the jet were waiting, after all. But she paused in the doorway.
I know it's a bad time with Marge and everything, she said. But we need to get our agreement squared away sooner rather than later. You just need to sign it so we can be done with all this.
And then she was gone. Swallowing my rage, I started up the steps so I could finish tucking London in. In bed, her eyes were red and swollen, and she barely looked at me. Later that night, for the first time in years, she wet the bed. In the days following our discussion with London, she was noticeably subdued and spent even more time in her bedroom than usual. The bedwetting continued. Not every night, but two more times, and she no longer wanted to read 2x2 before going to sleep. While she let me kiss her goodnight, she no longer reached up to put her arms around my neck for a hug. On Marge's recommendation, I spoke to her teacher at school about what was going on between Vivian and me. The teacher assured me she hadn't noticed anything amiss, other than a recent incident at the drinking fountain. London had somehow spilled water on her blouse one morning and immediately burst into tears. She was inconsolable and resisted both the teacher's and her classmates' attempts to comfort her. My daughter, in other words, was struggling. After her piano lesson on Thursday, I spontaneously suggested we go out for ice cream, but her reaction was tepid. I finally persuaded her to go, but she barely touched her ice cream on the drive home, oblivious to the mess the melting cone made in the car. Later that evening, as she was playing with her Barbies, I overheard her talking to herself as she leaned young Barbie toward Ken.
I don't want to live with Mommy in Atlanta,
Barbie said to Ken.
I want to live here with Daddy. Daddy is fun and we go on date nights and he lets me cook, too. And I want to play with Bodie every day and see Nana and Papa and Auntie Marge and Auntie Liz.
That night, I couldn't sleep, replaying the scene that London had enacted over and over in my head. Marge was right, I thought. Emboldened, I called Taglieri the following morning, making it clear to him that I was willing to do whatever it took to ensure that London lived with me. That same day, my realtor called to let me know that I'd received an offer on the house.
Well, you've certainly stirred up a hornet's nest, Taglieri said. It was Wednesday, 5 days since I'd conveyed my instructions to Taglieri, and he had called me into his office to discuss the response. I fidgeted in my seat as he went on. I got a letter from Vivian's attorney yesterday.
And?
If you choose to fight her on the custody issue, it's going to get very ugly. Basically, the attorney warned me that they're going to aggressively pursue a claim that you're an unfit father.
I blanched. What does that mean?
For starters, they want to bring in a psychologist to evaluate London and do an assessment of her needs and preferences. I mentioned that as a possibility to you early on, if you remember. London's so young, I'm generally of the opinion that it's of limited use. But depending on the psychologist they use, they're hoping to submit a report that bolsters their claims. Some of the allegations are frivolous. They're claiming that you don't feed London a healthy diet, that you sometimes feed her sugary junk food for dinner, for instance, or that your failure to get her to dance class resulted in her getting kicked out. But there are other claims that the psychologist might explore on a deeper level.
Like what? I felt slightly nauseous as Taglieri went through the possibilities.
That you're forcing London into a relationship with your new girlfriend, Emily, before she's ready.
Emily's son Bodie is London's best friend.
I hear you, and hopefully the psychologist will confirm that. But you never know until they file their report with the court.
He paused.
There are also more serious allegations in the letter. That you purposely endangered London by pressuring her to ride her bike down a hill, knowing she was still inexperienced and couldn't handle the challenge. Also that you failed to contact Vivian right away, and that you purposely minimized London's injuries when talking to Vivian to cover up for your ineptitude.
That's not the way it happened, I stammered, feeling myself flush.
Vivian knows it was an accident. She knows I'd never purposely endanger my daughter.
Taglieri held up his hand.
I'm just letting you know the substance of the letter. But there's one more thing, and you're going to have to stay calm, all right?
I squeezed my hands into fists, feeling the veins at my temples throb.
In the letter,
Taglieri went on,